welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. My name is Matthew Dawkins, and I'm here with my co-host, Eddie Webb.
Hello.
And Dixie Cochran.
About that.
Yeah, where is Dixie?
She's not feeling well. It happens, you know. This is a very kind of 24/7 job at times. And so, we're just going to go ahead and plow on ahead without her, unlike the last time where you kind of robotically phoned your answers in.
I do that every show.
Right. It's really unprofessional, and I don't want to say anything, but, you know.
Well, Dixie, if you happen to listen to this, we're sending you our love.
Absolutely.
We do hope that you feel better soon. The subject of this show, this two-hander, if you like, is what we look for in writers. And so Eddie and I have both developed a fair number of books at this point. Eddie substantially more than me. But we've both had vastly different experiences on a whole slew of projects with big teams, small teams, experienced teams, teams comprised almost entirely of new writers. And hopefully this show will be quite informative for people who are looking to get into the industry or looking to, I guess, win some points. Not that we score writers on points, but sometimes there's tricks of the trade that you just may not have heard of, and you kick yourself when you realize that this is something you could have been doing to do your job a little better, to earn a little more respect around the team. All in all, there's various things we can speak of with our experience, varying as it might be, that will hopefully help you, the listener, if you're interested in getting into RPGs. And if you're not interested in getting into RPGs, hopefully it'll be interesting anyway.
Yeah, and it's actually a good time that you and I are chatting about this, because just recently we did a top-to-bottom review of all of our writers and editors and developers to look at potential pay raises and the like. So we ended up having a lot of conversations about, you know, which writers we felt were writers that, you know, we wanted to reward more for their good service and the like. So this is very, very timely. It's very much on the top of our heads.
Yeah. I mean, that was a fun 2-day process.
Yes, it was very long. We have a lot of freelancers we work with. I think we still have 256 or something like that. It was...
Yeah, I mean, we had to move a few over to the archive, people who for some reason we didn't have any contact details for whatsoever.
Right.
So sorry, guys and girls. But yeah, if you want work, get in contact with us and you'll get added back onto the spreadsheet.
Yep.
What I particularly like about that, though, is the fact that we have such a depth of freelancers on our spreadsheets means we can have all kinds of interesting teams put their minds to books. And that, I guess, takes us on to an interesting first topic, and it's something I want to discuss with Dixie when she's back with us, and that's diversity.
Yeah.
But we can touch on it here, definitely. Because we've got these 200-plus writers, it means that a lot of our books can have a huge array of voices, and that can be incredibly important depending on the type of book. I mean, I know, Eddie, well, you obviously oversaw Neil on Scion.
Yep.
And Scion is a book that has benefited greatly from having diverse voices. Can you tell the listeners anything about that?
The transition kind of happened to Neil as developer. I remember very distinctly one of the things that he talked to both Rich and I about, and this was actually several years ago now, was that he wanted to get voices on there that were as authentic as possible. And I think he's definitely done a fantastic job of that. It's sometimes challenging to find writers who are both knowledgeable about the material and also interested in writing the material and can write the material. There's a lot that needs to happen there. But it is worth the extra efforts and challenge to make that happen. We've heard pretty strongly that a lot of people who've seen the second edition of Scion are very happy with the changes. They feel it does feel very authentic and very respectful to the various different faiths presented. So it's ideal to have someone who like is themselves steeped in the faith or the culture involved. That's not always possible, but someone who's at least very, very strongly knowledgeable about it. They just bring a lot to the table, and also just lots of discussions I've seen like on the Slack in the Scion channels we have. Just talking about, you know, hey, we thought about this, thought about that, and there's lots of jokes that frankly sometimes go over my head because I'm just not as steeped in the study of mythology as some of these people are. They're just very, very smart people. I've seen it directly improve the quality of Scion between first and second edition. First edition was not a bad game, but certainly second edition seems to be a lot stronger and better as a result of that diversity.
Well, yeah, I had a similar experience with Chicago by Night. I know I've harped on about it, but it's something I'm proud of it.
You
I'm proud of the acclaim Chicago by Night got when it was on Kickstarter, and the praise that it's received even since then. There's a thread on the Onyx Path forums right now where someone is basically going through reading the manuscript chapter by chapter and giving it a breakdown, and it's quite interesting to see. I don't often delve too deeply into fan discussions because I'm always conscious that their views might impact my own, and
right.
that's a fine line to tread. That's a topic for another podcast, isn't mm-hmm. it? But my point on Chicago by Night, I of course hired native Chicagoans. I hired people of varying races, genders, sexualities, and I wasn't doing it to tick boxes. I mean, God, there's enough accusations whenever you try and put a diverse team together that is what you're doing.
Right.
People who say that are really missing the point. The point of having a diverse team on a book like Chicago by Night is, look at Chicago. There are few cities in America that are so diverse, that have such a plethora of races, religions, cultures, and income levels all in one very small area, really. And being able to get that represented in the writing team really allowed for a genuine feel to come through. I've got a similar thing on Cults of the Blood Gods. One of the writers, their parents and their grandparents actually grew up in cults.
Oh, wow.
In various subsets of Christian worship that most people would find quite, shall we say, I'm trying to think of a politic way, but you get my meaning.
Right, exactly.
But I would even extend that to they came from beneath the sea and having writers of different ages on that book. I'm not trying to champion myself here as some paragon of diversity. I think I can always do better. And I know we spoke, Eddie, at one point when I was developing a book for you, and it was only after the fact that we thought, oh, wait, All the people on this were white, male, I think mostly European as well. This didn't really help, did it? And it was one of those kicking yourself moments that I feel we've both learned from. Because while diversity is, of course, one aspect, experience is another. Having a strong voice is another.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, while you would love to have a rainbow of writers on your book, it's also worthwhile having people who have the voice you need. And so, what in terms of what you look for in a writer, Eddie, for let's say the best contrast, I guess, Pugmire through to Vampire the Masquerade. What are you looking for in writers when you want to hire people for those individual projects? Can one person write both books?
I would hope so, because I've done it. It would be awkward otherwise.
Now we know.
I think there's an interesting voice is kind of a nebulous concept sometimes, and it's interesting to kind of dig into. So I appreciate the question. Because it's not just necessarily the words you write down. It's how you structure them, the word choice, the length of sentences. There's lots of technical sides to go with it, but also it's really just the things you choose to focus on. I think that people can learn to write in different voices. To touch back briefly on the diversity thing before we close that, some of the reason why I do hire diversely is because they're going to intuitively bring a specific voice to a project. For Dystopia Rising, I had a lot of disabled people on that project, including myself, because I wanted people to think about disability in the context of this environment. Post-apocalyptic genre, a lot of people will lose eyes, access to limbs, motor coordination. These kinds of things are pretty common in that genre.
Yeah.
But people can still write in other voices, and a voice that you're naturally inclined to is kind of, for new writers, what it's for first. That's why it's the reasons why we have the 500 words fiction, 500 words mechanics writing test that we do. Because I want to get a sense of what you think is a thing you're good at writing about. And that's kind of the default voice you start with. And I started with a very noir crime drama inspired voice. It's one of the reasons why I gravitated pretty quickly to working on Vampire in the World of Darkness, is because gothic punk is pretty close to a crime noir. And also I had that bit of a punk blue collar edge to bring out to contrast the very opulent, glamorous kind of slightly default state of Vampire the Masquerade. But at the time, I could not have articulated any of this to anybody. I just wrote what I thought made sense. As a developer, I have to look at that, what they're saying, and go, okay, can I extrapolate what it's going to look like? And sometimes it doesn't work out. Certainly, I've hired people that just turns out weren't quite a good voice. For example, actually, for the V20 ready-made characters, I hired someone who just turns out wasn't the fit I thought they were going to be. And then I hired you, Matthew, on board. And because I knew, having worked with you a couple of times, that your voice was going to be very reverential of the lore, but also willing to mix things up and present a new take on staid existing concepts. And that's exactly what I wanted for it. So I was like, I knew you could do that in a pinch and deliver well, which is another piece I want to get to in a minute. So that's when we talk about voice, those are the kinds of things that are going through my head. As what they're going to talk about and how they present that. And then I think once I get comfortable with a writer's voice, then I can see about stretching and going different directions. I know
that's a, oh, sorry.
You can't. Well, I think you're going to refer to you. It's just a sense that I want to bring up one example because I love name dropping on this podcast. Mike Tomasek, you hired him for The Game from Beneath the Sea, and now he's stretched into V5. And you've seen that.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, Mike would be the first person to admit that They Came From wasn't his ideal first assignment. Mm-hmm. I think it was one of the first books we hired him on. He did a perfectly fine job, but I wouldn't say that the content I assigned him to was what matched his skill set of the time. Right. Now, then I put him on V5 Chicago by Night because I like to hire writers more than once. It's always worthwhile finding out whether someone's got a voice they can apply to a different game. Mm-hmm. And it was also given the benefit he is from Chicago and loves his city. He wrote the city chapter for Chicago by Night, and it's one of the chapters most people seem to love. Mm-hmm. Now, I can hold those two drafts up against each other and say, okay, so I've got a natural vampire writer here, and someone who needs to work and practice a little before they can get They Came From Beneath the Sea.
Right, exactly.
And that's absolutely fine. It's one of those things when writers are submitting drafts to us, when they're making their submissions to Onyx Path to get hired the first time, a lot of people get a bit upset when they don't hear anything back from the first submission. But there's an amazing number of people who need to make more than one submission. Because it may well be that the voice you have submitted your first draft in, or your first sample in, isn't the voice we're looking for right now.
Right.
But if we can see that you can submit in different voices, you can, and here's the finest line, I guess. If you can submit for Vampire the Masquerade and Vampire the Requiem, and we can tell the difference
yes.
between the two, you are the kind of person we are going to want to hire. And that is a very fine line, I would say. You know, sometimes we've heard back from White Wolf and they've said, this book feels a bit like Vampire the Masquerade, or this book feels a bit like Vampire the Requiem when referring to the other game, and we have to make adjustments because it's something you can easily fall into.
Yeah. I mean, I know...
Speaking from my own... Oh, sorry, no. I'm even interrupting you. There's only two of us.
Actually, I was interrupting you,
Dixie,
to be fair.
Dixie, where are you?
the ghost of interruption passed. No, I was going to say is that... that's something, a good point, is that voice is not always something easily articulated. Because it's good that you mentioned Masquerade versus Requiem, is because the only reason why I understand the difference between voices is because Rose and I talked about it for about a year off and on. Because when I was the Masquerade line developer and she was the Requiem line developer, we were constantly trying to make sure those games sounded distinct from each other. And we need to make sure that we could tell writers, okay, I know Eddie wants this, so I need you to do that. But that was a long conversation, and a couple times we just frankly changed our minds or we got it wrong. And we were always like, you know, well, it's kind of like this, but kind of like that. And so it's even as an experienced developer, I can't always tell people what a game line's inherited tone is. For something like Pugmire, I'm able to kind of craft that a bit more. And you were able to do it with the Game for the Sea, is say, okay, this is a brand new game. Here's some examples. I need the tone to be X because you have to be able to explain it in order to get other people on board this brand new property. But going into an existing property and saying these 100 books aggregate to this tone is very tricky sometimes. So at those points, I kind of want to bring up Mike, is that it's not – it should be shameful to not always get it right the first try, like you say. Sometimes it's, you know, shift them to a different project and they just shine like crazy in that particular environment.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say one of the biggest challenges I've had as a writer, I've written for both Requiem and Masquerade, and often in quite close proximity to each other. I've written for 3 Requiem second edition books now, I think. And all the while, I've been working on V5, or I was finishing off Beckett's Jihad Diary, or what have you. And it really is an interesting tonal shift that you have to make in your head, almost consciously. In fact, I would say that conscious switch is the vital component. I think if you ease yourself in to writing these games, your work can come across as generic.
Yeah.
And because Vampire the Masquerade has been around longest, and here's the heretical point I'm about to make, Vampire the Masquerade is the more generic game. It's from my perspective, and maybe that's just because I've been immersed in Masquerade for so long, but I feel because Masquerade has that more existential feel, it seems to be more about society and more about and almost, I guess, more about politics.
Then
you can kind of take it from a rather impersonal standpoint, whereas Requiem is, as has often been cited, a game extremely about personal horror, about personal loss, tragedy, and hope, and power. And for that, you really need to start mining into the things that that, frankly, that scare you, the writer, that entice you as the writer. And while that has a place in Masquerade as well, I would say one definitely plays more to one aspect than the other.
So I would push back. I would say that generic is not the right term for what you're looking for. Abstracted is kind of what a term I've used before with Masquerade. Because with Masquerade, I mean, you're dead on in terms of the nuances. Requiem is a much more personal, street level, who do I punch today and feed off of tomorrow style of game. Masquerade, prior to V5, I should clarify, was really much more about the horror was in looking at people like concepts rather than people. Even young vampires, you really start ending up looking at people like food. And then the people above you look at you like a tool, and the people above them look at the people below them as things to get their way. So you're never looking at someone as a person. You're looking at them as their clan. You're a Bruja. You're a Neonate. You're an Insula. You're a mortal. You're a ghoul. You don't have a name. And so the tone of that naturally gives a bit of an emotional remove from the material. And I think it's intentional. That's also why again, in previous editions, I actually encouraged a little bit of capitalization of terms, which is something I'm normally very strongly against, because I wanted that slightly Victorian out-of-date look to the text to give it a sense of this feels a bit old and static without being boring. And that's a tricky balance to walk. Whereas Requiem, reading a Requiem book is not a boring experience. I mean, it's very visceral, especially the second edition stuff. It's very in your gut level, in your face, which Rose is just fantastic at, and Danielle is just fantastic at getting out of people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone likes to cite the clan books for Requiem, which, of course, are first edition, but they very much set the mold for second edition, those books and Damnation City, of course. Actually, there's a whole bunch of the ones at that tail end of second edition, and Damnation City was kind of the middle, but first edition, I should say. Anyway, I'm rambling.
The clan books, yes.
Before we get too lost in these Fair weeds, enough. I would like to talk a little more about writers that we've hired. Let's say they are writing their first draft. They've read your outline. Mm-hmm. It is now time for them to write their first draft. What are the common pitfalls that writers can stumble into if they're not careful?
The biggest one I've seen is just not. My first thought said not reading the style guide, but I don't think it's fair. Not internalizing the style guide, I think, is a more accurate assessment. Because you can certainly read a document and go, okay, cool, I'll follow those rules, and then not actually follow those rules completely when you're writing the material. And this goes back to the tone thing we talked earlier. It's actually a very important piece of it, is that how you use words, where you capitalize them, how things come across on the page, starts to tell people, perhaps subconsciously, that they're reading the right kind of book. So little things like putting a space around an M dash, that's something that's pretty unique to Onyx Path. Very few other companies actually do that particular style change.
Whose fault is that?
I'm gonna blame Justin Achille because I think it's his fault. I don't know, actually. I inherited that particular thing. It's something that now established, okay, I'm reading an Onyx Path book because, you recognize these little details. And so when you don't write in that style, that's something that the developer and the editors have to course correct on, and they're not spending time thinking about the content of the material as much anymore. Because they have to get it just to look in the right shape, as it were. So I think it's a big one. The other big one I would say for new writers is being afraid to ask the developer where they can contribute. I'm seeing this less, actually, which I'm heartened by, but I know earlier on in my career when I hired writers, I would say, this is what I need you to do. Give it to me by this date. And then they would go, okay, boss. And then I would never hear from them until the date. And then the dates would come. They would give me a manuscript, and it's not actually what I need. It falls into one possible interpretation of the outline that I wrote, but is not actually the material I had hoped for. It's an understandable mistake to make. I mean, it's certainly not like I'm angry at them for doing that, but rather it's a case of if they had said, actually, hey, I'm digging into this. I'm noticing that it could go X or Y. I'm not sure where to go. What's your thought? I could say, cool, do Y. And then that saves them time and me time to be able to do that. It can sometimes certainly be frustrating where it's like there's a lot of questions that might come across my desk. But at the end of the day, that's as a developer, that's my job. My job is to take those questions and go, okay, I need you to do this. And also say, I don't care, surprise me, because knowing that something cool might come out of that, I have to make room for the writer to do interesting stuff in that space that is unique to them, because otherwise, why did I hire a particular voice if I didn't give them room to actually have that voice? But if they're genuinely not sure which direction to go, shooting me a quick email or a quick Slack message, and I can go, yeah, sure, do that. Or, nah, actually, I might have thought to do the other thing. It saves everyone a little bit of time. So being proactive certainly helps.
Oh, certainly. It's more helpful than panicking. And obviously, everyone has a panicky moment, especially on their first few assignments. But reaching out to your developer and asking for guidance, that is what the developer's getting paid for. So I would certainly urge any writers or prospective writers listening, never feel like you can't approach your developer or your co-writers for guidance, for assistance, for a wee bit of tutelage, because, again, That's the developer's role. They are there to help you turn in the cleanest possible draft you can. And so this is actually a discussion I recently had with one of the writers on Cults of the Blood Gods, where we were talking about how clean do you want your first draft to be. And this is something I imagine some developers differ on, but speaking personally, I like for if a writer is prepared to submit a first draft to me, they should feel like it's as good as it's going to get at first draft stage. I don't tend to want to see a brainstorm dump in a first draft format that is a zero draft or maybe even less than a zero draft. That's the kind of thing you should be discussing with me during your first draft phase. So if you, especially if you do that, if you do that and think that's going to be acceptable without checking, I think we will have a serious problem. If, however, you have come to me during the first draft process and you really can't find your voice or you can't find what it is you want to write, and you say, what I really need to do is compile a bunch of ideas and I need you to vet them, there's the possibility I might say, okay, submit that as your first draft and we'll go from there. But for the most part, I think you should treat your first draft as if it's going to be your final one.
I want to pull out one example that you and I went through recently. You had me working on an upcoming project on some V5 worksheets. And it's the first time I had worked on worksheets. It was a new concept to me. And so I got on a call with a couple of the other writers. They were talking about some of the content and how that would fit into worksheets. And it ended up being a really good way that we can approach how to do those. And we came up with some cool ideas that I think would not have happened with me in isolation and probably would have been a slightly more either a difficult redline process or may have led to you going, you know what, I'm not going to bother with trying to make this course correction because it's a little too far gone. But because it was earlier on, we were able to make some adjustments and changes because we had that discussion. And I think that kind of stuff is very important because it does lead to a potentially cleaner draft. Sometimes things happen. I know I had a writer turn in something recently where there was a chunk that's like, you know, I'm not sure what to do here. And they were getting close deadlines. They just gave me the drafts with a little, like a 500 word section. Like, all right, I'm not sure what to do here. And another place I was like, you know, I'm not sure if this is the right call. That's fine to me, but ideally I'm the same boat as you is that if things go catastrophically wrong and I have to somehow turn that first draft in as a final manuscript, I need to be able to do that.
Yeah, I do think if you get a draft in with a 500 word, 1,000 word section or what have you that says, I didn't know what to put in this point, I feel like, well, the reason you've had a month and a half to 2 months, maybe a bit longer, to work on this first draft is to give you time to
ask. Sure, it's fair.
And that may sound a bit cruel or callous or cold, but I guess I have fairly exacting standards when it comes to writers, and that shouldn't be seen as I'm a tyrant. I try and get the best out of all of my writers.
Benevolent tyrant.
And yeah, exactly. I like to think that anyone can come up to me, anyone can have a meeting with me, you know, you can get on Skype and call me, and we can talk through anything. And the reason is because it's purely selfish. I want as easy a time as possible in red lines and development. I want this book to go through as quickly as it humanly can. And that means if I get a draft that's full of holes, I developed a book relatively recently, and this is almost the horror stories of book development, but where someone had a 10,000 word submission they were supposed to send to me. Every time I checked in with the writers, I was getting thumbs up. Okay, yep, everything's on course. When first draft finally came in, I got, I think it was 800 words of the 10,000 word assignment. And some questions at the end saying, well, you know, these are my ideas. This is what I'd like to expand. And I thought, you've actually worked for us before, writer who shall remain nameless. But I'll tell you what, you won't be working for me. And yeah, that again may sound cold, but I spoke to the writer. They thought this was okay, and I explained, well, was it okay on the previous? Well, I asked, was it okay on the previous book? No. I said, well, there's nothing different here. We hammered it out. We got to the point where we just had to part ways on the project because they were a bit rudderless, and I should have been that rudder, sure. Eddie. But in this case, either it wasn't working as a team between us, or it was just a project on which the writer couldn't grok with the material as they
like. And I think that leads to another good point about when we look for writers is that proactivity. Because all of these projects are ultimately, the modern term is distributed offices. These are, you know, we're all working remotely, as it were, from each other. We don't see each other in context unless we arrange time for that to happen, whether it's via Skype or a Skype call or whatever, or a Slack or whatever. So you have to kind of say, hey, I have problems. Hey, here's where I'm at. And you as a developer have to be able to say, you know, hey, where are you guys at? And can I help out? So in this case, you didn't know that you needed to be the rudder until it was too late. And so I agree, that's not okay. But being able as a writer to be able to say, I'm not sure what to do here, that's to be honest, that's terrifying. From an anecdotal perspective, just now I'm working on a project. It's a Pugmire project with a different company, a video game company, I should say. And I'm doing outline with them, and we've gone through now 4 revisions of the outline. And all the comments they're bringing back are perfectly valid, completely agree with them. But I was just not getting my head wrapped on this project. And it's a Pugmire related project. I know Pugmire and I know video game writing. And it came down to for the first couple of drafts, did not ask. I assumed I knew what I was doing. And I made some decisions that were the wrong direction. And if I had just said, okay, I actually don't know what you want from me here. Can we talk about this? Because when I actually copped and said, okay, I'm actually a little lost here, they explained it a couple times and I got it. Oh, okay, now I get it. But that could have saved me 2 drafts if I had just asked. So I get that that's hard to do. It's hard to be able to say, I don't know what's going on, because there's always, especially as a freelancer, there's always that fear of, well, cool, we'll hire somebody else who does. It's so vital to be able to swallow that pride or to tamp down that anxiety and just do it, because 95% of the time, the product will be so much better and the process will be so much better if you do that.
Well, let's talk about team players then, or the necessity for them or lack of necessity for them. So I feel like collaboration is a big part of a good book. A good RPG is one where the team work together, shared ideas, and all sort of G'd each other on. But not all writers are in a position socially when it comes to confidence or simply time. Not everyone has a full, is committed to this industry full time. I would say, in fact, a good 90% of the people that work for us, maybe even more, are doing this as a second job. So expecting them to be on board for every meeting or to be reading every other writer's drafts to give them feedback is a bit much. But, you know, when they do, it's brilliant. What's your advice, Eddie, in terms of team working? How necessary is it? What books benefit from it most? And how much is too much?
That's an interesting point. I will say that a lot of my current thoughts on team building, I have flagrantly and completely stolen from you. Because 2 years ago, I wasn't using software like Slack. I wasn't doing team meetings. I was just doing the kind of traditional, here's your outline, here's your assignments, email me up questions, and I'll email them occasionally to see if they're okay. And the process worked fine. Obviously I did 40 some books that way. But when I tried out, your process, I want to say it was on Mao. I did that first, where I got a Slack channel.
That was the first time Yeah, first time I was on a Slack channel run by you.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was right. Monarchies and Mal, I got a Slack channel together. And then with Soapy Rising, I actually started doing meetings. And there is a massive amount of difference in those two projects. And you're right. I mean, like, the more you put into it, the more you get out of it. So certainly if you're able to constantly contribute to something like a Slack, able to show up to all the meetings, able to share emails with people and get thoughts from people, your first draft is going to be stronger and your final draft is going to be stronger. There's a certain amount of that where if you can't, that's okay, because really at the end of the day, that's the developer's job. The developer's job is to make sure that there's a unified vision, not necessarily the team's job to have a unified vision. But like you say, the more they can make the developer's job easier, the better it is for a developer to think about other things and to find ways to make the product that much more effective. But in terms of things, definitely just being able to, if the project requires you to work with another writer, just being polite and civil and working with that person. There's a lot of etiquette stuff that comes with being a good team player. Sometimes they're not going to respond to you right away. Finding the right ways to follow up politely to make sure that they got your messages, to make sure that they're available to chat. When to escalate to the developer when there's a concern. And then just trying to make it work. But also, I think it's a big part, being clear what boundaries are. Because I do think there's danger of being a little too much of a team player, like you say, which was interesting you brought it up, but it's something I've been thinking about recently. Some people get very excited about working on projects and want to talk. They can't talk to anybody else because they're an NDA, so they'll talk to their team. And they need time to actually get the writing done too. And everyone has their own process. So what you think is the right time to have a conversation may not be what their process is the right time. I am a horrible procrastinator, and it's something that I've struggled with my entire life. I found ways to work around it and to make the procrastination work for me, but it doesn't change the fact that I procrastinate. So there's been plenty of times where people are like, it's been 2 weeks in the project. I want to talk to you about everything I'm doing in my thing. And it's like, I haven't even started thinking about that yet. It's going to be probably another 3 weeks before I do. It's just my process. Is that I will, last week or two is when I get stuff done, but it works for me. Other people want to get done right away, and I get that. So being sympathetic and aware of those boundaries, and say, hey, am I bothering you? When's a good time to talk? Rather than just, oh my God, I got ideas. I want to talk about them all the time. Blah, blah, blah. Finding that right structure. And also, if there's a section that you're impacting on, making sure you're coaching your commentary as advice and thoughts rather than you must do this. Because again, people can sometimes get excited and it's like, oh my God, there needs to be the Giovanni punching a Solubrian face in the section. And it's like, okay, but I'm writing the section and I don't want to do that. So no, you definitely need to punch the Solubrian. It's like, okay, well, Neil, we need to pull it back a bit and think.
Well, that's definitely not.
Well, that's why I use Neil's, because that will never actually. It's a hypothetical situation that will never actually occur.
But no, that's a very good point. And this is going to make the writers listening probably worry. So apologies that we don't want people who don't contribute, but we don't want people who contribute too much. And I guess the way that I would translate that. is to try and read, as you've said before, try reading the room. Gauge the enthusiasm of the other people. Don't constantly throw out lengthy ideas for other people to use, because ultimately you're responsible for your assignment. Give advice when it's requested, but don't just dump all your thoughts on other writers.
Yeah, certainly. There's a balance between, hey, do I want to hear my idea versus, hey, here's my idea.
I mean, one of the very first Vampire the Masquerade books I worked on had one of the writers basically throughout the process trying to change the outline for the developer. Everyone was already working, but the writer was basically pouring all of their ideas on the developer and saying, hey, you know, I think this would be a better idea for this book, rather than just working on what they've been assigned. And by no means should writers be treated as, I guess, that they are not A to B process driven. There's an awful lot of complexity that goes into any kind of creative role. But certainly if you join a book and rather than, first of all, wondering how am I going to tackle this assignment, instead of that you think, how am I going to change this entire book to make it better, I would say you've got the wrong idea about your role. And indeed, I don't think there's anyone who should have that role on a book other than the developer.
No, I completely agree.
So but when there's only two of us, we get through material pretty quickly. So we want you back.
Yes, please. But we're treading water.
God, what else do writers do? Red lines. No.
Well, actually, one thing that I think might be worth digging into, because we've done a lot of do this, but don't do that, but also do this, but also don't do that. I think you glossed over a point that I think is worth digging into, is the fact that this is a complicated process. And also, I cannot think of any book where the development process was identical. All of them are a little different from each other. Each project requires a slightly different approach and the writers to take a slightly different tack. Certainly if you're working on a game line, you can get pretty close to the previous one, but there's always going to be something that pops up. Writers that can be remain flexible, I think is a big piece of a lot of what we're talking about kind of bunched together, in the sense that sometimes it's like, okay, you know what? I'm trying to think of an example. Okay, let's use Pugmire because that's the safest example. We scheduled this book. The Kickstarter didn't do as well as we thought, so now we have to cut 25,000 words. So can you do what you were scheduled to do, but shorter? Things like that. We need to add this chapter in because the licensor needs us to address this material that we didn't talk about. So I need you to quickly come up with new material. Not everyone can do that all the time. And that's another big piece of it, is that you don't have to be flexible. You don't have to be perfect all the time. Certainly it helps, but if you make mistakes, doesn't mean like we're never going to use you again. It's more along the lines of if you can come back from that and work again, you're fine. So that's part of that flexibility, is like, being able to say, you know what, I'd love to, normally I could, but I have something else on my plate. I can't pick that up for you right now. Or I'm digging into this and I may not be the best person to handle this section. Maybe I can swap with another writer who seems like they have strong ideas for it, and we can switch our places in the outline.
Oh yeah, that in particular is something that you don't see enough of, but would be invaluable if more people did it. I would far rather people came up to me early on and said, I'm not terribly comfortable with my section, would you be okay checking with this writer whether they want to swap? Now, without any pressure on the other writer, because they may be perfectly comfortable where they are, that saves so much pain and heartache if you can just get writers to swap around early on. Because much of what we do as developers is guesswork. Yeah. When we assign people to a book, we think this is what they will be best at, based on the experience we know they have, or we expect they have, or interest they have. But we can't know if their secret interest has always been to write the Kia Seed. And so we assign that bloodline to a different writer, and leaving them with a true Bruja, for instance. Mm-hmm. But on the subject of, I mentioned red lines kind of jokingly, but something I look for in writers when it comes to red lines is, for the love of God, take notes.
Yeah.
Because the first few red lines you get will probably be pretty red. Mm-hmm. I mean, developers, if they're worth their salt, will give you good advice with it. We'll try and be constructive. You will see it, hopefully, as a teaching experience, and they will see it as a... Well, you will see it as a learning experience. They'll see it as a teaching experience. Right. That's the ideal situation. And if you are seeing it as a learning experience, I have no doubt the first time you get your red lines, you will think, my God, I'm an awful writer, I'm never going to write again. A lot of people think that way. But once you get past that feeling, and you start reading what the developer has to say, you'll probably find that a lot of it is quite on point. Don't take that to mean your work is always going to be like this. Yes. Take that feedback, note it down somewhere where you can refer to it. I actually have the red lines I get most often on post-it notes on my desk. Really? You know, they're just right there for me to look at. I've got a virtual post-it note on my desktop with some things, but I have actual post-it notes on my desk to remind me every single time I do something in writing or development, look for this overuse of this word, or don't structure a sentence like this, or whatever. If you take those notes the very first time you get your red lines, and probably the second time as well, come the third time, you won't be getting those points highlighted in red lines anymore, right? Because you will have learned. One of the best, the simplest ways of learning for anyone to learn is write down what you've been told. It's the oldest teacher trick in the book. Copy out this page from this textbook. Yep. It's not a very good training or teaching technique, but it's a simple one. And for a lot of minds, it can really be the difference between reading text and taking it in.
In fact, one piece of writing advice I got early on in my career was take three different writers that you respect that have as different of styles as you could possibly find, and then transcribe a page from each of those as possible, because then you'll start to – and like physically handwrite them, I should clarify, because then – as you're writing the words, you're internalizing to a certain degree, like you say, why that sentence is structured that way. You're engaging with the text in a very different way than just reading it. And by doing three different styles, you can see, oh, okay, I see it. In this time I did it this way, but another time I did it that way. So something that early writers can do is, like, you know, take a chunk of the book that you're writing for and just transcribe that page. Or if you don't have time for that, just do a very careful word by word read of a representative section of the game.
Another thing, what I look for in a writer is someone who is unafraid to read other writers' work on the book. So if, let's say, I will use a bunch of examples of people that I've worked with for whom I have a great deal of respect when it comes to their writing quality. And I would say Malcolm Shepherd, Megan Fitzgerald, Danielle Lauzon. I know we often use them as developers. There's a good reason for that. Chris Allen, Leith Shields. I will, if I'm working on the same book as them, when I get to red lines, because our red lines are usually stored in a communal place, mm-hmm. I will look through their drafts and I'll look at the red lines they got. Because, not because I'm interested and I'm a voyeur and I want to see what they got wrong. It's because I want to see what they got right. I want to see, you know, what they're doing that sets them apart from the pack, if you like. And everyone can be excellent. Everyone can be turning in top quality drafts. But with humility, being able to read your co-writer's work and not feel like it's like you're somehow stealing from them, I guess, or that you're somehow admitting defeat. And this is all stuff that's easier said than done. It's a learning experience. Be prepared to learn and be prepared to teach yourself, because it's a self-employed industry. Yeah. There's so few people that will, to be candid, hold your hand all the way through it. You do need to, as Eddie said, be proactive and take those steps on your own in some cases. So hopefully advice like this helps.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually one of the reasons why I know we talk about this stuff a lot, but I personally think it's important, because there isn't a manual for RPG writing specifically. I mean, in the past decade or so, there's been a really strong increase in game design in colleges and the like, and there are textbooks, but almost all of that is geared towards video games. Usually other styles of games are meant as kind of an introductory one-on-one thing to learn how to build a game, a good game, and then you can figure out how to apply that to video games. So the engagement from RPG design is pretty rudimentary in terms of objective academic approach. So we're constantly learning. This is all on the job experience for everybody. We're making shit up as we go along, frankly. And a perfect example of that is the communal red lines thing. I never did that for a long time, because I had had it hammered in my head that writers do not want to share their shame with other writers. You know, it's like, so I would email each person their red lines directly. And when I saw people like you and I think Neil was doing it also, a few other developers I know started doing kind of, here's all in one folder. And I was just like, huh, is that okay? Am I allowed to read other people's drafts? It's a dumb question to ask, but it had been so hammered in my head. And so when I tried it myself, I saw the same result too. It's like people started going, oh, hey, guys, I looked at your thing. And I was also able in the red lines to be able to say, go check out chapter 7 for a good example of this.
Yeah. It's a good way of picking up on developer direction too. Because if I'm the developer and I decided to add to, I don't know, Dave Brookshaw's draft, that I think we need less focus on Atlantis here and more focus on because Dave would be the person to focus less
right,
on
exactly.
And more on Transylvania, but for whatever reason I didn't put that in your draft, then that's something for you to query. That's something for you to take on board as well. It's not necessarily the strongest example.
No, I know what you're saying.
But point being, that there's an awful lot you can glean, and I completely understand what you mean about the idea of shame when it comes to red lines. There, you have to put yourself out there when you're a writer, and I don't mean necessarily from a networking perspective, although that's again different subject. I mean you have to make yourself a bit vulnerable, because you are potentially writing quite personal material, especially when you're writing horror, and someone is going to be, for all intents and purposes, judging that work and saying this works, this doesn't, change this, change that, and hopefully this will make it better. And yeah, you can feel ashamed or shame if you have somehow missed the brief or you didn't deliver your A game or use whatever terminology you like. And getting past that mentally is a challenge for a lot of people whose only exposure to having work reviewed is school or college. Yeah. Where your tutor, your lecturer will mark your piece, will give it back to you, and they won't say share it with the rest of the class, because usually when a teacher does hold up a an essay and say this person got an F, let's tell everyone why, right. It is to shame the other people in the class. Not to damn all the teachers out there, but it's something most of us have experienced at some point. Because some people believe in teaching via humiliation, the idea that fear is what will make you great. And I disagree completely. And I think one of those things I look for in a writer is the ability to overcome that fear, the fear of failure, and to take pride in your work, but also take pride in the work of others, learn from other people. Learn from your development.
And definitely, I want to reiterate that the fear doesn't go away. Like I said, I've been doing this for almost 20 years now, and I still get butterflies in my stomach when red lines come in, even from people that I've worked with for years. It shows that you care about the work. You know, because you put your heart into doing the best job you can do, and then people come back saying, well, I need you to do better. On a gut level, it's the, oh, I didn't do my best, even though you know you did. And it's you can intellectually get past it. I allow myself like a few minutes to feel nervous about it and then just dive in. But don't feel like you're a failure because your brain's telling you you are, you know? There's an emotional component to any creative work, and you're going to have, if you're doing well, I think you're going to have some investment in that kind of work. And so you should feel an emotional response to that. If you're doing well, if you're passionate about your work, if you love your work, if you care about the project, that's going to happen. So don't, it's not a sign of shame. It's not a sign of failure. If you go, oh God, I'm worried about this. No, it's like, okay, I'm worried about, try to get, trick your brain to go, okay, no, let's dive in and make it even better. You know, and be a, feel free to talk to your developer and say, did you mean it like this? If it's coming across as curt or harsh, you know, feel free to say, you know, did you intend this to land this way? Because I know a couple times it happened to me. I'm like, oh God, no, please. No, that was not my intention at all. I'm just trying to help you out.
I've got, just before we wrap up, because we're coming to a close, I've got an interesting tidbit, something that we put in our outlines and don't often talk about, and it's required and, suggested and required reading. If I write in an outline that I have required reading for my writers, I will be able to tell, come your first draft, if you have not read the required reading.
Yep.
And it isn't because I'm trying to trick you. It's not because I've put something in the book that's inaccurate and I want you to stumble over it to prove that you're wrong. It's usually something about tone or structure. For example, in the Let the Streets Run Red, the Chicago by Night stretch goal book, it's a book of scenarios, basically, with V5. I requested people take a look at Giovanni Chronicles 4 of all books. And that's because I think Giovanni Chronicles 4, despite the fact that a lot of people dislike it because you're no longer playing the characters you played in Giovanni Chronicles 1 through to 3, is a fantastically written and well-structured book. I really love the scenarios in Giovanni Chronicles 4. And so I love for people to take inspiration from that. Now, I can tell if they've just gone off on a tear and haven't used that as inspiration. Now, if any of them are listening to this and they're thinking, oh God, we haven't read it. my point is, your work may be absolutely fine. It could be absolutely top quality and you didn't need to read it. But if you're a brand new writer and I'm asking you to read something so you can get a feel for the game, especially if you don't know systems, for God's sake, read. But if you don't know setting, it is really going to help you to read what the developer tells you to read. And we build that in. That's why first draft phases tend to be fairly lengthy. It's so that you have enough time to research as well as write. And when you're a writer in one of our books, we will furnish you with free PDFs of the books you need. If there is a book you particularly need for your draft, ask for it. We will get it to you.
Absolutely.
So, any closing thoughts, Eddie, on what we look for in writers?
There's still a lot, but for the writing craft specifically, I think the biggest kind of takeaway is don't be afraid to make mistakes. Because a lot of the stuff we talked about here are shows that it's a very subjective craft. There's objective things that can be done. And I'm hoping that we can actually reconnect with Dixie at some point and talk about editing, because I think it's where the more objective craft things fossilize a bit more. Not fossilize, they gel. The objective craft becomes more important at the editing phase. A lot of the stuff is kind of, I know it when I see it. So, a writer who's open to communication and gets a buy off to try a new thing and then goes and tries a new thing and then pulls it off is great. Like you said, to talk, hey, go back to Chicago, the passion that went into that setting chapter for Chicago clearly showed to the readers. That was a bit of a you know, you got the right person to say the right things at the right time. And from what I understand, a lot of just like, I need you to do X, Y, and Z, but otherwise, go do it. And that was a bit of a risk and it paid off really, really well. Certainly if there's something in your section, it's like, I think I could do this better if I tried this instead of that, can really pay off. But until you're at that level of confidence, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to get it wrong. Now, the first two or three times, you're going to get heavy red lines. That doesn't mean you're bad. It means you're learning. Being willing to take risks, being able to accept mistakes, gets you really far.
I think that's a nice way to end it. So, with all that said, I do hope this has been helpful to prospective and new and established writers who work for us or for other companies. There's a lot of advice packed into this episode. We have even more we could probably tell you in another one. But I do think that hopefully I do hope that this has been helpful to anyone listening and interesting to. So without further ado, Eddie, if people want to find you, where would they
go? You can find me on Twitter at Eddie Fates, and also on my website. Those are both EDDYFATE, eddiefate.com. Or you can find me just about anywhere for professional reasons at Pugsteady.
Lovely. And you can find Dixie on Twitter as at Dixie Cyanide, like the poison. And also, Dixie, we miss her when she's not here for these episodes. Obviously, I think she's been, well, I've had far more absences than Dixie has.
Yeah.
But I've got to say, Eddie, yeah, I don't like this two-man job. It's
this is awful. Let's never do this again. I mean,
yeah, this isn't going to work for me. No, you know, this is it. It's interesting to experiment with something like this before I get onto my contact details, because there's going to be times when one of the hosts isn't around, and right. So we'll have to do it with two people instead. And so hopefully that's not been too distressing to the listener. And if you want to find me on social media, because I'm weaving around subjects like a drunk thing, you can find me on YouTube as The Gentleman Gamer and on the Onyx Path YouTube channel. Check that out. You can find me on Twitter as Clack Click Bang. You can find me on the Onyx Path forum as The Gentleman Gamer. And you can find me on MatthewDawkins.com. And you can find me on Patreon as Matthew Dawkins as well. Because, God damn it, I'm going to get all your money. So... Many Worlds, One Pathcast.